The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Some content in this audio is not covered under a Creative Commons license. For more information, see the course materials on the MIT OpenCourseWare website.
Grabbing a bunch of index cards and scribbling things down.
Yes.
That's pretty much how I get started. All right. Another group?
So our group is me, Alec Owen, and Jason.
Yeah.
We don't have a rapid prototype, but we're doing a real-time supernatural horror cooperative game.
Okay.
Oh, the like real-time survival horror thing you like about that?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm excited.
That's
going to
be good. All right, cool. So 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, who else?
It's me, Tanya, Patrick, and Justin, who I guess isn't here.
You guys have kind of
Our game is called Saturday.
Nice.
How do you describe this game?
It's a building a family tree game.
Sort genealogy of. Path building.
Yeah. So it's a path building game involving
competitive
family members.
Genealogy path building.
So it's kind of like a Family Feud game, except a little bit stranger.
So I think Jay and Dion?
Exact same thing happened.
And Calvin and Jason are in your group, and Baldwin and
they were here on Wednesday.
We had problems communicating.
I already see where this is going.
Yeah, good. So right now we have we don't have a prototype. The idea we have is pretty much you want to get a certain set of cards,
mm-hmm.
and the way you get sets by drawing cards or trading with other people. Or,
mm-hmm.
But there's also you can take cards if you want. But if you get cards, then it's up to the other players whether you get punished or not.
Okay, if you get caught, then okay. So I think that's gotten right now. That sounds good. So it sounds like we had four teams. You might have got a chair
right here.
All right, so today I'm planning on, for the most part, just going through the lecture stuff that I had planned for both today and for last Wednesday. And if there's any time left, we could finish as good as it. And that's what I'd like to do. But if there's only like an hour left, then I think I'd probably rather you play one more game. Us versus it is a useful exercise, but playing these games are just as useful and frankly better designed. All right. Let's see. So I'm gonna start with Wednesday stuff first, which is the last Kalawa reading of the entire semester. I did, in fact, actually look a little bit into the weird Eskimo stuff from Monday, and one thing, I don't actually think he was speaking figuratively. I think he was actually describing something that he had done some anthropological research on. This is a ritual that certain very, very vaguely defined group of Eskimos, you know, do. It reminds me a lot of the sort of recitations that you get that sometimes have a morbid quality, sometimes they don't, but they sort of like remind you of either historical events or important things to do. Like the easiest one that I keep remembering is like righty-tighty, lefty-loosey, right? You know, it's like that teaches you something about how screws work. But then, you know, there's also like ring of roses, a pocket full of roses, tissue, we all fall down, which is actually a commemorative little poem about the Black Death. That's what that song is about. So you have these little things. That particular example that he was describing was more about this recitation lets you sort of remember the procedure in which things are supposed to be able to be done. But the sort of gestural reenactment about what you do in order to, I guess, what was it, cut the foil or something like that, to basically perform taxidermy on an animal. One of those ways where a playful experience was pretty much just being used as a learning tool. And that kind of gets back to something I was mentioning much earlier in this course. And in many ways, learning how to play a game is literally learning something. You can't figure out how to play a game unless you figure out all the rules. And if the rules happen to have some sort of correlation to something real world, you might end up learning something about that real world. Whether you transfer it back to actually something real world or something like this, it's kind of actually the topic of what Wednesday's reading about. Quick Kalawa talks about, you know, mimicry and illings kind of being taken over by Agon and Aaliyah. Now, he uses these grand sweeping statements, which I think sound a lot more modest when they're in the original language, and when you translate them, they sound like he's saying, and this huge wave of competitive games took over witch doctors. And it's like, but I think what he's referring to, and if you notice, the readings were like chapter 3 and chapter 8. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's missing, and you know, you kind of want to spare you from the bad translation. But the idea is that there is a lot of stuff that basically mimicry, the whole process of like being, you know, putting on masks, putting on costumes, and being someone else, you know, has great societal power. At least had great societal power. And this is more of an anthropological thing. But the idea being, you know, you have these people who are effectively leaders of groups, you know, shamans, witch doctors, fortune tellers, maybe just elders, and they will have costumes, they have masks that not only gave them station, you know, so it said, well, when I wear this robe, I am now in charge of this tribe, but also turned them into somebody else. If you look at ancient accounts of Egyptian pharaohs, for instance, you notice they kind of give up their old name and then they take on a new name, and a lot of them actually just become pharaoh in the same way that a lot of Roman emperors just become Caesar. You can think of Caesar as just being king, you know, so become a title, but you also become a person. A lot of the I'm trying to remember Persian, I think, emperors become Darius or Cyrus. I think this one word and this one name that's just given to the kings. That's who you become, and that's kind of combined with sort of aesthetic sort of rituals. You know, a lot of these are not what you would recognize as game right now, but in many ways, they sort of tap into the same sort of pleasures of sort of vertigo and losing control. You know, once in a while, you don't have to be sort of all inhibited and obeying laws. You can just cut loose. And superstition will be the excuse. But you don't actually necessarily need that reason. And I think one thing that sort of describes in chapter 8 is how we kind of get that today too. And he was describing stuff like identification, for instance, when somebody who, you know, who could be you wins something for no particular good reason against incredible odds, and if there's some sort of mechanism for you to feel, I have now had a part in this person's success, therefore I'm a winner. Then you get to have that experience of ecstasy. You get to let loose. So a couple of videos, sort of in tongue of cheek, in tongue in cheek, but hopefully, let me just pull it up. Hopefully, it kind of illustrate my point as well. If the network gives me any bandwidth. So, was anyone here in Boston in 2004? You were in Boston?
No.
In 2004. What happened in Boston in 2004? Yes, the Red Sox. The Red Sox won after, what, 86 years of coming real close and never actually winning the World Series. And I'm going to this is a neat little video that I showed that I have. I just kind of just use this as a backdrop. I think this is Rally Around Fenway. Oh, I must have shared my bandwidth. Sorry, the wireless in this particular corner of the office is pretty bad. This is actually let me skip a little bit. So, for those of you who don't know the story, actually, how many of you don't know what happened in 2004 around here?
Well, I don't know exactly.
Definitely. basically, what happened around here was the Red Sox was down 3-0 against the Yankees. And managed to come back from that, and then they beat the Cardinals and they won the World Series. Now, this is of course after 86 years again. I mentioned of like really people just not winning at all, but coming really really close. Each time they get really really close, and then they magnificently flub it, and for once they landed. So this earlier video here is what Boston looked like when it was down 3-0. I'm not sure if it's got audio. And that's outside Fenway. Because the funniest thing is that every time like the Red Sox actually won, it was like in a away game. So they weren't at Fenway. They when all of these celebrations that you see once the buffering stops. That all the celebration that's going on is occurring miles and miles, from probably 100 miles away from where the game's actually happening in the Cardinals. But of course, everyone was watching it on TV. Everyone's identifying with the Red Sox. Right now it's just sort of seeing, like, as far as I can tell, probably the Northeastern students. Who were around Fenway, but in here vehicles driving by, and orange, their horns. Everybody was listening on the radio. You can see cars driving by. Everybody knows immediately. Everyone in Boston immediately knew that Boston had won. If they weren't watching the game, they would have heard it. Everybody shouting at Lisa. Because they have no affirmative claims. The only way that you cheer the Red Sox is to say Yankees suck, which is kind of sad actually. Anyway, for those of you who weren't around, it was a really, really awesome night. There was of course a little bit of violence. Things got a little bit out of control. It was fairly sad actually, because I think someone got killed by a road bullet. But it wasn't like a huge riot or anything. For the most part, it was just pretty much this. A lot of people with a lot of their hands in the air. No cars being turned over or anything like that, but it was being. This is akin to the kind of ecstatic movements that Kalua talks about in his write up. Yep.
I have a video on my phone of Barcelona right after they won the semifinals over the summer, and I have a video of the streets at 11 p.m. I could trade off with
Blake. Sure.
And I have a video of the streets at 12:30, so half past midnight, and it's the exact same scene.
Yeah.
And people, the exact same people are still in the street with their shirts off, still like twirling their shirts.
It was probably more rowdy,
I would imagine. Oh, it was 10 times more rowdy.
Yeah. No, because this one.
This is Americans. They don't know how to be rowdy.
Well, actually, I think for every like three people, there was a cop. You're not seeing that in the video, but there were a lot of cops out that night. Just to make sure that it wouldn't go out of control. I think in Barcelona, I think the cops would have been partying too. So the idea of course, the idea of a sports team is something which you identify with because associated with the city that you live in. They win. I didn't do anything, but because I'm a supporter of the sports team, I get to identify myself with them. And Kalbaugh makes the assertion that this is important because if you look at the sort of the forces of pure chance of Aliyah, which actually gives the various athletes the opportunities as well as the physical ability to actually perform well, the likelihood of any of the people actually celebrating actually being able to perform that same feat is extremely low. And in fact, the likelihood of even someone who has the ability and the opportunities of actually winning is pretty much random and the odds are against you. But because you identify so strongly with a group of people who can win, you are allowed to sort of enjoy that victory, even though you weren't the one who actually got that victory. And it gets stronger actually for some games. For some kinds of games where you actually did have something to do with the victory, for instance, talent shows, especially the modern talent shows. Maybe you've already seen this.
Righty ho, the phone lines have now closed. Please, please don't call in now. It's too late for your vote to be registered, and you may still be charged if you ring now.
While the votes are counted and verified, we can remind you about the Britain's Got Talent Live Show. It's hosted by Steve Mulhern and Scott and June. Ooh.
So while the yammer about next week's show, they're gonna. Remember that when you look at things like Britain's Got Talent, like American Idol, all of these things are popularity contests. You have judges, but the judges don't actually determine very much who's actually going to win. The only people who actually determine who's going to win are popular vote. And that vote is happening through short messages, basically, which people are being charged for. And the basic idea is that because you might have had voted for someone, you now identify with that person who might win. Whether that person wins or not is effectively random for one of the purposes. Now, sure, there's some of them have talent, but later on, but when you look at who actually tends to progress in these competitions, I think some of the results are really, really random. Like, you have some people who get who move on to the next stage because they are just strange. And you just want to see them next week because they make things entertaining, not necessarily because they're talented. So this is going to be a good example. I like the way how they
guess what their talents are.
Dancing.
That's an obvious one. Singing,
probably. Singing. I think about cleaning up.
Stripping. Troy, how are we
participating? Getting married.
Cyprus? What did they do? I actually looked up what those particular things did, but they can all do different things.
I'm going through the one with the most votes, and as an act, the second will be chosen by the judges from the next two most popular acts. So, here goes with the result of the public vote.
So the first one is short message voted.
So who will be joining Susan Warren, Diversity Callers, and Shawnston in the final, and who will be going home? Let's find out. The winner of the third semi-final and going through to the final of Britain's Got Talent is...
My slick back hair.
I love the camera moves at this point. You don't even know what it did that you're celebrating.
They're in Cyprus. They're obviously
church
from Cyprus.
Yeah, well, they definitely is. It was like a dance thing.
Wow.
And if you look at the other celebrations, like the Susan Boyle video, which I think it got pretty viral, so I'm assuming a lot of you have seen it. It's one of those things where you're, even if you don't necessarily that you're rooting for a person. It's so easy for you to be convinced that you're actually rooting for this person as soon as you have a reason to. And so it's like, oh wow, that guy is from Cyprus. Let's root for him. Yeah, you don't really need that much of a reason to identify with something. And it's that where you can sort of still see some of that power of Vertigo, basically. Yeah, it's not the vertigo of actually playing the game, it's kind of the vertigo of watching a game, but it's still part of the entire game experience. Britain's Got Talent, American Idol, everything like that wouldn't have the power if you didn't have the hundreds and hundreds of screaming fans, you know, voting in and having their faces changing on camera and applauding and screaming their heads up. So that's, you know, and of course that was kind of, that's the identification part of it. But even like when you're talking about, you know, sort of just basic rituals, here's a shrine festival in Japan. And basically what they're doing is just getting started. You know, everyone's gotten assembled. All the folks here who are wearing basically the same colored outfit are basically from the same town, including that little girl. And what you've got is basically, you know, it's like a little house for a deity that both carry on their shoulders. And those three up there look really precarious, but I think they're having a good time. That's a completely different town, and no one should. But you know, you can sort of see it. You know, this is not unlike what you see in a sporting event, right? You know, it's kind of getting
around. Is it town like competition?
It's not really so much of a competition, but I think there's a certain amount of you have to represent.
And that show exists in France. It's called Atapi, and they literally get like towns in the countryside and have them compete in various competitions. So like each town, for example, designates the strongest person and have an arm wrestling match.
And like champions, right? You send your champion.
You send your champion, and then they have like an obstacle course type thing, and I think and, like other weird events. It's ridiculous. And it's extremely popular. It's, you know, it's 1,000 people person town versus 1,000 person town.
I think you get it. In the Scottish Highland Games as well, right? You know, you have towns basically sending people to throw giant pieces of lumber as far as they can. But this one is less of a competition. This is not Argon. This is a lot closer to kind of the Aliens kind of situation, because they're not vying to win anything. They're really just trying to all get into it together. So you know, if you can think of it as a co-op kind of thing, you know, the aim of the game is don't drop the damn. You know, quite simple, you know. Get from. In fact, it's actually a fair amount of effort, because I think they walk a couple of miles. I'm not quite sure what the traditions are of where it starts and where it ends. But you know, it's like a huge street parade. And the whole idea is let's get everybody involved. You know, the people are close, packed really close with each other. So it's not like you can actually move one foot without colliding to somebody else, unless you're all moving in unison. So. Can you keep in sync? And all the shouting, all the whistles, and all the chants actually just help that entire process move along. And this continues to today, not just in sports, not just in televised shows, but you know, in street fair and some of that. It's great. And those folks really look like they're having fun. So that's kind of what we were, you know. I have a few more other videos. The version of what Kalawa describes as, you know, since your ability to succeed is so random, especially if you think about it outside of the game context, but more in societal context, your ability to be a great athlete, your ability to be a great politician, your ability to make a lot of money, just to succeed in life, is so random. But people kind of don't necessarily want to acknowledge that it's random, because you have rules, because you have sort of rules set in to sort of promote merit, to sort of equalize systems. To use the word equilibrium a lot, which I think actually he meant, I think the original word was like egalitarian. While there are a lot of forces trying to stabilize, in the end you can't really ignore the forces of one's birth. At least that's the way how he sees it. When you get competitions that are effectively just completely random, which means anybody can win, people really do understand that, you know, and sort of ascribe to that kind of power. They accept the likelihood of me winning the lottery is about as good as the likelihood that I'm going to succeed in life. A lot of it is based on who was I born to, and you know, and which year was, and which generation I was born in. What's happening in the world at the time? At least that's the way how he puts it. So here's a really hilarious video, by the way, that I found. This is an ad. let me get
for university.
I guess so.
Sorry about this. Yeah.
Hey, it looks very pretty.
You know, most of us, when we buy a lottery scratch off ticket, if we just win $5, we're thinking, man, this is my day, right? Okay, well, if that's the case, a 19-year-old Owings Mills College student is super lucky tonight.
Louis J. became an instant millionaire with the scratch of a ticket, and he told Rob Roblin all about it today.
It was on his birthday when Towson University student Louis J. decided to buy a scratch-off lottery ticket.
I actually won $20 on a scratch-off the prior week.
Louis went to this giant Owings Mills and used the $20 he won on a scratch-off ticket and bought another one. As he began scratching off the numbers, Louis couldn't believe his eyes.
I'm at the second to last line, and it's not going too well. And I was like, I see six. I was like, oh, it matched up. All right, I won $30 or something. Why not? I said, a million. I was like, no, double-checking, triple-checking everything, make sure all the numbers matches and everything. I was like, oh, my God.
And when it came time to scratch off the last number, his mother told him,
he was scratching off every one. And when it was the next to the last one, I said, don't scratch it from right to left. Do it from left to right.
Oh, snap.
Oh, my God. There it was. Lewis had won himself $1 million.
This little dollar sign bag right here that I won on, I matched number six with my lucky number right here, and down here matches to six with the prize for $1 million.
He's a hard-working young man, and he has fun, and he likes the lottery. He buys a ticket on his 19th birthday, and lo and behold, he wins $1 million. I don't know if he told you the other part of the story. He bought a ticket on his 18th birthday, his first one. I think he won $100. So I don't know what's going to happen on his 20th birthday. Everyone in the family is happy about Lewis's good fortune.
Happy for him.
Just, isn't it a story that they're trying to tell?
And yes, he does have plans for the money.
I'm putting some money away for my brother and sister to finish schooling. They go to a Metzville school. I'm going to put some money away for my loans for myself, help my parents pay off some bills so we get all... we always said what we'd do if we won the lottery. We'd go to England, visit my father's relatives and stuff. We're going to go there next summer, hopefully. Just going to do a lot of things. We always said, what if we won the lottery? And now we did.
Rob Roblin, WBAL-TV, 11 News.
So, you know, if you listen to the story that they're trying to tell, you know, it's like, this is a hard, he's a hard-working young man, as if that had anything to do with his
performance.
He deserved it.
But the behind that is that, well, and if you're a hardworking person as well, and if you bought a lottery ticket, you could win. That's the story that they're trying to tell.
I wonder if that was right on the last
chance.
If Justin is like a first-time prostitute, he like wins the lottery, like, you know, what is the... when a really, really like unlikable, despicable character wins the lottery, what's the news report going to be like? She never worked a day in her life.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing, I think you can still turn that in a way of, this is not a person whose odds in life were already, you know, in favor. And everyone can sort of identify with that. You know, it's like, yeah, things aren't quite working my way, and then, but you could be a lottery winner tomorrow. That's the story that they're telling. And of course, the idea being, what the lottery director was saying, yeah, you know, remember, he didn't just buy one ticket, he bought one ticket the year before, he might buy another ticket the year next. He's trying to to encourage you to buy more tickets. And that's the story. The story is buy more tickets, which, oddly enough, is actually the only way to increase your chances of winning the lottery. So just buy more tickets. Pity that doesn't work for, like, you know, Has D or something.
I remember Has D.
Maybe apply for more Has D classes, maybe you get into one. But the basic idea that they're trying to get you, because the forces of life are so random, these kinds of like totally random high stakes games have incredible power. Not just because of the possibility of winning, but because it resonates very, very strongly with the idea that you could win, you know. And if you identify with somebody else, even better, because then you don't even have to win. That person could win, and in fact increases the range of different winners that you can identify with. It helps people and sort of get that thrill of winning without necessarily even having competed. So that's kind of the power that we have in chance. I haven't actually talked about, well, so how do we actually use chance in games yet, which is what Breathwaite's and Schreiber's stuff was more about. But I think in their book, they describe the reason why I like challenges for game design is that they're very concrete about, well, if you're stuck and you don't know what to do with a game, have you considered bam, 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 bam? They're very, very systematic about that. You know, have you considered doing options? Have you? Oh, sorry, that's not a chance. That's the second chapter. The first chapter was like, have you considered, using dice, using cards, using spinners? I can't remember what other randomizing systems they had. Pseudo random number generators and stuff like that. Are you using it to equalize what different skill levels? Or are you just trying to make it so that there's some unpredictability, there's some unsolvability in the system? There are all these different ways that you can use randomness, but don't forget how powerful randomness is. You know, it's one of those things where you normally assume that you don't actually want in a game, and you don't want in a complex system. First of all, as a designer, randomness makes it hard for you to predict what's going to happen, and as a result, it becomes difficult to design. But the power of I could be a winner for reasons entirely out of my control is actually more powerful than, you know, than a lot of folks will naturally assume right off the bat. So I'm not going to go too much into the various options that Brenda and Ian described in challenges, because you can look those up. But do look those up, especially if you're having difficulty in your game. If you're having difficulty, oh, this game is too predictable, and you can see that there is an optimal strategy, well, you know, then you can think about, you know, maybe randomness might be a good thing to put there. I want to be able to play this with people who've never played this game before and let them still have a fighting chance. That's another way. That's another good opportunity to win randomness. But know what problem you're trying to solve before you throw in something random. Because sometimes you can have a lot of fun with games that are effectively just like fun lotteries. I draw a card. And Munchkin is kind of like this, actually. You draw a card, oh, look, it's funny. And you read the text, that was silly. And now they've added a Twitter version of Munchkin where every hour they introduce a new rule. And it's like, the player whose name starts with the letter M gets double the hit points or something. It's like totally random. And that can be kind of fun, but that's really short-lived fun. That's one of those things where once you look through all of the cards, the game is pretty much done for you. Even if you haven't even finished playing the game might be done for you. So try not to go down that trap. There was a group last year that did a game where pretty much you just like drew silly things to do out of a hat. And it was fun until everyone looked through the hat. And then, you know, once everyone knew pretty much the range of different silly things, that's it. The game was over. There was no replayability. So keep that in mind. A side note about replayability. There's actually a really excellent essay on, I think, Gamma Sutra about how replayability isn't actually a well-defined word. Nobody really knows what that word means, but everyone uses it. So if you're interested, check it out. I haven't actually had a chance to form a real opinion about it yet. It is.
Okay. So, by the way, a lot of the roots of the kinds of randomness things that we use, like dice and cards, have some sort of root in fortune telling, which connects it back to kind of the ritualistic aspects of games again. You know, the idea of, you can tell whether you're going to be a success in life by a success in this game, right? You know, and the game might be draw a card from this deck and hope it's good. you know, which parallels what a lot of people think life is. You know, it's like, I'll roll this dice and if I'm lucky, you know, things are going to work out. But there's a couple of interesting things about how strategy and skill start to work with things of randomness. For instance, there is one argument that Kalawa makes that the reason why you get things like chance and skill games taking over mimicry and vertigo experiences is because we started developing systems of enumeration. We started being able to count, we started being able to rank things to tell whether something was actually better than other in some sort of empirical numerical way. So if you think about it from that sense, then actually when you look at skill and when you look at chance, they're actually kind of on both on the same side. They're sort of dealing with number systems one way or another. If you have a system that has a lot of chance, any number could come up, any card could come up, any dice roll could happen to some set of probability. Then what skill is dealing with what could happen, you know, having a plan, having a strategy. Maybe that element of chance isn't a random die roll. Maybe it's a person that you've never met before that you're playing against. You know, and you don't know how good they are, they don't know what their strategies are, they don't know how they play, they're effectively a die roll, you know. And your skill is kind of, or the elements of skill in the game are all about how do you deal with all the probabilities that would happen. So one of the things that Kalawa talks about is, you know, a lot of the competitive games kind of things actually come up from tests. Tests of physical skill, tests of mental skill, tests the ability to be able to take an administrative position in uniform society, that sort of thing. But your ability to actually do well on those tests also kind of depends on your luck of having the ability in the first place. You know, it's like, did you get the right kind of education? Did you study the right questions? Do you happen to have really good genes so that you can jump really high? That sort of thing. So, you know, the idea of whether it is actually just luck of, you know, if you talk about a modern game, you know, you can talk about the skill of someone being able to play chess, or you can talk about the luck of somebody having had the chance to play chess many, many, many times before they're playing this one particular game. Because not everybody in the world has that option. And that's the kind of the case that Kalawa is trying to make. When you're bringing a new person to a game, you know, they haven't had the luck of playing your particular game. I'm going to say the good fortune of having of playing your particular game, whereas you have had that. So if you wanted to think of it as that as, well, that's their bad luck. Now how do we use rules, either rules of chance or rules of skill, to be able to give them a fighting chance? Fighting edge, probably more rules of chance. So there's a couple of different things. One thing that I do want to bring up is the Shannon information model. Oops, wrong window. Sorry. Could probably just draw it, but I just want to make sure I get it right. I'm going to consult. Because I need to redraw this sketch.
I can also probably shift it over to the big screen.
It's really blurry. Yeah. So it's incredibly blurry. Okay, all right, so this is the basic idea. Claude Shannon, back in the 60s, I believe, I think here in MIT, in fact, basically came up with a model of how communication works, how information gets from a sender to a receiver. This has anything to do with games, I will get to that quickly. But let me just talk about the model first. So the sender has some sort of like message, right? And they're going to send it, and this is transmission, I believe. This is transmission. I'm going to shorten it and say X. So a sender has a message. They want to set up. They want to transmit it, and then it needs to be received. So reception by the receiver. In between the two, there's some sort of channel. So if you think of this as, you know, I've got a computer and my message is an email and I'm going to transmit it through the internet. And then it's going to be received by some sort of other mail server, and then it's going to be understood. But this is the important part of this model, is that this is where noise gets in the channel. The reason why this model is useful for thinking about games is you can actually think of the sender as the game. This is game state. And the message could be, you know, something, could be valuable information about the current state of the game in order for you to make a good decision. In poker, it would be, well, everybody's hands. That's the message. That's valuable information. If you knew what everybody had in their hands, and if you knew everything in the deck, in the order in which the deck is shuffled, you will be able to make great decision about whether to raise a bid or default. And so you have rules that sort of encode what that message is going to be, and you have rules that and you have strategies that help you figure out what to do with that. So the receiver kind of becomes, you can think of it as the player, but I like to think of it as the player's decision engine. Or the player strategy, if you were thinking about it over a long-term strategy. The trick is noise. And noise is actually something that you get to control, also with rules. What is hidden? What is obfuscated? What can be deliberately introduced to confuse you about what the game state actually is? But noise can be random, or noise can be just plain old, you don't know. Just deleting information out of the pot. So, for instance, you guys know the rules of Texas Hold'em? There is a set of cards in the middle called the river. Correct me if I'm wrong, for the people who really know the rules of Texas Hold'em. And these cards are dealt pretty early in the game. They're not dealt right at the beginning, I believe, but they are they dealt right at the beginning?
No, not at the beginning. Not all at once, Dave. Right?
Yeah, the first three.
The first three is the flop. Yeah.
Yeah. The flop and the river. Right. Which is the one that's face up?
The flop turn and river.
The flop is face up.
No, the flop is yours. Everyone gets dealt the two cards, and then you turn the flop over, which
the flop is
three
cards, and the turn is the fourth one.
Yeah, and then the river is the fifth.
The river is fifth.
So you only consider betting with your own hand.
Well, no, technically when you deal, you put one card face down, then you put the flop.
But that face down card doesn't have anything to do with it.
Right, but
it's
I don't know what...
Yeah.
So, but those, the cards that get dealt out is pretty much an unknown. You know, it is random. But for all intents and purposes, if you just took five cards and put them aside, you know, and then just dealt them out, it's a fixed quantity, but you still don't know what the heck it is. You know, someone else could have picked those cards and still don't know
what it is. So they're effectively, you know, a random thing for you. They're noise. They're a bit of information you don't know. And in Texas Hold'em, a bit of information that everybody does know. So that's great. You know, the information is kind of equally shared among everybody except for the one part that we call. So when you think about how you can even things out for different players, or how you can make the challenge a little bit higher for seasoned players, you can think about, well, how much information am I currently giving them about what the game state is? And maybe I can obfuscate them. Not necessarily lie, just hide. You know, just deny them information that they necessarily need. It's also a good way to sort of think of, well, maybe if you're a little bit behind and you need a little help, then what you can do is give them a slightly less noisy channel. Let them, you know, and the next card that's coming up, because we're talking about card games here, let them reroll the next die roll, or something like that. This model of like thinking of what sort of information are you giving your player can also sort of be useful in thinking whether you're giving too much information simply from a decision-making point of view. It's like, I'm throwing all this game state information, but really, all the player needs to know is half of that in order to make a good decision. You might actually want to consider reducing that somehow. Let me think of an example. I think Settlers is Settlers of Catan is actually a pretty good example of that. You can see the entire board. Everyone can see the entire board at any given time, and everyone's got cards in their hand. You don't know what other people have in their cards, but for the most part, when you're trying to make a decision about what to do with your cards, you're really just concerned about your cards. As time goes on, you pretty much know what other people have in their hands if you're paying attention, because people are picking up resources fairly openly. But you don't really care. And that's one nice thing about Settlers, is that they're hiding this information from you, even though this information doesn't need to be hidden. Because in order to make a good decision in that game, you do not need to know that information. So they're introducing noise. They're deliberately hiding information from you, so that you can just focus on the two or three decisions that are actually worth making on your turn. And that's one reason why Settlers games actually go pretty fast, because people aren't paralyzed by too much information. If your game's getting too long, if your game's supposed to be half an hour and it's taking an hour long, think about the information that you're giving your player. All of it might be relevant to the game state, but not all of it might be relevant to what the player needs to know right now, in order to make your next move. And if you can find some way to control that, sometimes just with clever color coding, making your card in such a way that is really, really obvious that there's a certain part of the card that you need to look at certain times, and you can kind of ignore it outside of all other times, then that might help. But often what I find is in a lot of games like European card games, for instance, or board games, they would use a lot of icons to describe what the value of something is or what kind of effect it has. And the reason why they use icons instead of using words is because you don't have to translate icons. And they want their games to sell in Germany, in Spain, in England, and in the US, in Greece, and Italy. And so if you made cards, you couldn't use those same cards in every one of those territories, so you use icons. The only problem with that is that now you have to learn what every one of those icons means. If it's just a stack of coins, oh, five coins means five, okay, all right, I can sort of figure that out. That's fine. But this is a picture of a hammer. What does a hammer mean? I'll have to check the reference manual, which happens to be in 6-7-9 with this. So that's one of the barriers that a lot of folks have to European card games and board games. It's not necessarily that the games are all that complicated, it's just that you have this extra layer of translation that needs to be done, because they're not really built for one language. So, I probably have more to say about information, but I'm going to save it for the next class. Any questions so far? everything that I'm sort of throwing at you right now are pretty much just different ways to look at the game that you're going to make. You know, it's a hard game, but try to sort of like see it from different ways. Not just how do I get this one game mechanic to work, but you know, what are people going to be getting out of this game? When they're going to be drawing this next card, how are they going to be feeling? You know, are they going to be feeling excited, apprehensive? You know, are they going to be counting on a next card to win them the game, or is this just going to be giving them options? And do they know what options they have? That's what I think.
So,
2:14.
Okay. All right. So, I'm gonna skip through.
Right, I'm just going to do a complete transition at this point, so new topic. One thing that I want to talk about, which is not actually covered in any of the readings, is about emergent gameplay. I think you've probably heard us, Jason and I, use this phrase quite a bit. We haven't really defined it all that well. But if you think of the definition of what a good game could be, Sid Meier offers a good game is a series of interesting choices or interesting decisions. So what's an interesting decision? One argument is that an interesting decision is one where they're using mechanics to affect the game state. You know, and you're going to get some information. You're going to use that mechanic and affect the game state. The game's going to respond in some way. And how that decision you made corresponds to the result that you get back from the game state could be interesting. If there's no correspondence at all, if it's completely random, or even worse, completely predictable, then these are not interesting options that you've got. If it's that result logically made sense, but I didn't expect that it was going to do it, or that turned out better than I expected, now it becomes really, really interesting. If it's just it could be anything, it could be awesome, I could win this game, which is next time, oh look, I won. You know, that's not interesting either. So if that's an interesting decision, Eric Zimmerman calls it a meaningful decision, then the converse will be a meaningless decision. So like a game like what I just described, you know, a decision where making a choice doesn't actually affect your outcome. You could win with this next card flip, but you had to do the card flip anyway. You didn't actually have to choose to do it. Then you know that's not a meaningful decision. Or you make a decision and then no change in the game state at all. Well, that's not interesting either. So what you want in your games is something where you've got a system that's nonlinear, that's still deterministic. You know, all of your rules will result in some sort of outcome, but nonlinear enough that you can't really sort of anticipate the entire entire possibility space when you're making that decision. If you're thinking of games as a huge possibility space, then you as a designer, your job is to try to make the most traveled areas of the possibility space interesting and fun. So, actually, do folks know the phrase possibility space? It's if you think of a game as just a series of turns or a series of decisions, then possibility space is basically every single result that could come out from every single legal decision in your game. Some of them are going to make sense, if a thing lost in process, which now I'm getting back to the pounds of discussion, and you know, someone's got, you know, 0x0, and it's my turn. And putting an X here will make sense. Putting an X anywhere else, no, doesn't make any sense. So I would argue that putting an X anywhere else really isn't
well, okay, it is part of the possibility space because I could put it here, 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 here. You as a game designer, your job is to make sure that the things that people will rationally do are interesting. You do not have necessarily any responsibility for somebody who's just trying to play your game in a way that's entirely not what you planned. You know, say somebody plays one of these card games and says, well, I'm just going to play all my game, all my cards face up, you know. And no specific rule that said that I have to hide my hand, but you know, later. But you don't really need to cater for that. It's nice to have a rule that explains, okay, this is what you should hide your content is crucial to your game. But for the most part, when somebody plays your game in a way that doesn't logically make sense, and you know, they're not really obliged to make sure that they have fun. On the other hand, when people are making rational, you know, when people are making rational decisions, you know, somebody puts an X here, and then the next move goes on, and they're designing this game. Then you know, it's your job to make sure that, okay, within the realm of the things that are legally good and strategically make sense, we're going to try to make that game as interesting as possible, as much fun as possible. That's your job. See. So, in order to sort of like help you figure out how to get that, you know, the reading from Poundstone today introduced a few terms. If you've already taken game theory and economics class or a math course, you probably already know these in far more detail than you necessarily needed for game design. It's useful. But, you know, utility is a very useful concept. It's difficult to quantify sometimes when you're talking about just like regular game design as opposed to just pure mathematics thought experiment. But the basic idea is, you know, if utility is like how willingness a move is. Is the likelihood that something is going to actually cause you a win, and in some ways, it's a measure of the gains that you're going to get. So, I believe Poundstone's example has this like ridiculous game where you guess whether somebody has flipped heads or tails, and the person is like literally just like choosing whether it's going to be a heads or a tails, and you just guess. The idea being, you know, heads, tails. So this is the guesser. This is the flipper. So if the guesser guesses right, the guesser gets a point, and that's a choice of the reward. If the flipper chooses tails, the guesser chooses tails, or the guesser will also get one. And if not, it reverses. So the flipper gets a penny if the guesser gets it wrong. So you can sort of tell that, you know, just by looking at this, this is a ridiculous game. You know, it's like at best your average over multiple games is just going to be zero, right? On average, is just going to be zero. So, and he uses this example to describe how you can come up with a strategy where you're not basically doing the same thing all the time. In this particular case, he's advocating that the best way to win this game is pretty much to break even in this game, and that's to just play it randomly. You know, every single time, just really call out the winner. Because as soon as you get consistent in either your guesses or your flips, then you are now at a disadvantage. But what you're trying to do in this particular case, the likelihood of whether it's a head or a tail, and you know, you're actually doing it randomly, that's great. But if you throw in a hint and say, well, if it both comes up heads, instead of doing one of winning one penny, you win $1 million or something. then suddenly the probability that the flipper is going to choose heads drops like rocket, right? It's not a wise strategy. If the flipper chooses heads 50% of the time, then the guesser is going to be winning several million dollars pretty soon. You know, they'll be losing a couple of pennies once in a while, sure, fine, I'll lose a couple of pennies, but I'm just going to guess heads all the time. And, you know, sooner, and if I know that you're guessing, that you're flipping heads 50% of the time, I'm going to be getting $1 million sooner or later. So, in this particular case, the way how the flipper balances it out is basically to flip tails about 1 million to 1. I think it's more accurately, it's like 1 million to 2. So it's like, you know, for every 1 million tail flips, I'm just going to throw in a head flip every once in a while. Just to force the guesser to occasionally guess heads. Because if the guesser knows the flipper will be crazy to guess heads all the time and does tails all the time, then the guesser just guesses tails all the time, and after 50 games, the guesser is ahead 50 times. So the idea is every once in a while you throw in a head. And it's roughly the opposite probability of the utility. Approximately. The numbers don't quite work out that easy, but it's close. At least in the scale that I'm using right now, 1 million to 1. And when you're talking about balancing a game, if you can actually break down a decision in your game, say a particular decision that a player's got to make given a certain hand, or having a certain card, and now they can make one or two or three decisions. And if you know your card distribution well enough, saying, well, 30% of the time, decision A is going to be good. 20% of the time, decision B is going to be good, and the other 50% is going to be decision C. Then a balanced game, at least one definition of it, is that the utility of all those decisions, the benefit that you're going to get out of that, maybe is raw winning points, you know, victory points that you need to be able to get your game, maybe some sort of cash. The benefit of actually making that decision should probably be in reverse proportion of those numbers. So the thing that you will pick 50% of the time, you know, gets you, let me see what I can do up. So, say you've got decision A, B, C. Actually, I'm not sure if I need three columns for this. I'm actually really bad at this. I'm going to bother for this. C is good 50% of the time. B is good 30% of the time. A is good 20% of the time. I think that's what it's good. If anyone knows how to do this better than me last time, what are you trying to do? So the idea is that A should give you disproportionately higher benefits. Not disproportionately, but should give you proportionately higher benefits than C. So C gave you, so if C gives you...
Is it meant to depend on your current strategy?
See what?
Meant to depend on your current strategy?
I'm just taking pure probability right now. Assuming that you're just playing against a system. You're not playing against a new person. So, say, doing decision C gives you 5 points.
If you do it with 30, the numbers might work out better.
See what?
If you use 30, the numbers will work out better.
Okay. 30 points for... 50.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
60
is a very nice number.
Yeah, that's easy. Okay, that's the problem that I was having. So, if you choose B, then what sort of what sort of benefit should you be getting?
20.
About
20?
Yeah.
20?
18. B only works less of the time. This is the percentage success.
Oh, wait.
to them 30, 48,
like that.
Yeah,
it's
18. Well, it would be the other 48, right?
Yeah. I would say 50.
I'm going with 50.
I'm going with 50. You want the multiplication between the probability and the value.
Yes. So when you multiply them, you have to put
7. And what would you do?
75.
Yes.
And this makes it a situation where choosing A, B, or C becomes fairly even. You could choose A, and you could get, and 20% of the time, you've got a pretty good payout. I'm really terrible at math, so I'm going to assume this is right. But this makes it so that you don't have an immediate dominant strategy just by looking at your cards. You know, it's like, well, obviously, I'm just going to do this all the time. This is very, very, very basic of us, you know, and I'm crap at doing this sort of thing. But every once in a while, it's a good idea to actually just like write out the numbers. You know, okay, I know that my player, my opponent is always going to have 5 cards in their hand, and out of the 5 cards, they're going to have some combination of cards that's going to result in, you know, the probability of ABC success being like this. You know, so I have card A, I have card B, I have card C. I could play any one of those, and making that decision, you know, you want to give them rewards that are inversely proportional to the risk. That's one way that you can balance a game. It is very much a first step. This is how you mathematically take that first step, and then you actually need to. You actually need to test it out after that. You can't actually just assume that that's going to work out. But it can get you pretty close, which is kind of nice. If you know, you're getting a situation where, okay, we're still seeing a dominant strategy, but it's only a small number of, then you know you're in the right ballpark. Actually, those can sometimes be the hardest kinds of games to balance, because you keep making really small changes, and you never really get there. But still, you can get into the same ballpark with that. That's really the only context that I found utility to be a useful concept for actual game design. It's an interesting concept to be able to talk about strategies, to talk about decision making. But when it actually comes to now I'm going to sit down and design a game, this is the only time when I've actually used anything like that. If you found better uses for utility, please by all means share it, because I have not. Okay. That's pretty much all I have
for the talking to you today.
Any questions?
Utility. When we played the dice game,
The
game where you can either put down tokens or roll dice.
The
kind of strategy I developed in the game we built based on like different dice and things.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a utility model. If you're trying to maximize mm-hmm. utility, if you say like if you win, you expect your value, your utility is 1, if you lose, your utility is 0.
Yeah.
And then like you can do a bunch of math to try to like maximize the expected value of that.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean the thing about it though, of course, is if the math that you do basically says, well, the way to maximize your expected value is just to do the same thing all the time, and in that particular game, you know, there's a very standard strategy that tends to work. Then you've got a game that's not interesting. Then you've got a game where those decisions that you're asking someone to make don't actually matter because there is someone that's ready. So yeah, that game is a fine example of a game that could use more work. I'm not going to say it's a broken game because it was specifically designed for the purposes that we used in that class. Here's this game, now go improve it.
But yeah, that's a good game where the utility is pretty obvious, right? You know, it's like, how far are you going to get? Well, I could take this token, or I could roll a die. Wait a minute. On average, they all come out to be about the same. So it doesn't matter anymore. My decision is no longer interesting.
No, I mean, it didn't have to be interesting, right? Because the whole point was that the meaningful lever that you're pulling is the variance table, right? Mm-hmm. Your expected value is the same. That's also the case when you're doing this kind of computation, right? Where you're analyzing risk versus reward.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's incredibly painful to not get the reward. Sometimes you just want consistency. So imagine Settlers of Catan, where you can go for a strategy where you have a diverse set of numbers that you can possibly roll. Mm-hmm. Or you can just get a bonanza payout and roll like a 6 or something, right?
Like
usually it's better to go for consistency because you'll get robbed of
you can get a large range of numbers.
Yeah, because the chances that you'll get a huge payoff off turn and then a 7 will be rolled before you get to spend your stuff. So it would have been better off just generating consistent stuff. Even if in expectation you generate the same amount.
But in the back of your head, you always know that you could go for the big payoff version. And usually
but
in a game...
What I'm saying is there's a meaningful difference between these things. Even if your expected value in computation shows you that there are equivalent strategies for them, the variance can really be different.
That's and actually
also means like these decisions are very different. If you're playing like a three-player version of Settlers, you want to be like, very diverse. Whereas if you imagine if there were a version of Settlers where there were 10 players, you would want to like cluster all around a couple different numbers. Because then it's unlikely that if everyone's diverse, everyone's about equal. So you'd rather have a little bit of a probability of being like way ahead of everybody than having like just be in the middle of the pack the entire time.
So basically, again, counting on the huge payout.
Exactly. But that comes down to like variance. And where the expected value of the resources you get isn't the same as the expected value of like winning the game. Where you're really trying to maximize like the percentage of winning and not necessarily the percentage of resources.
There was a really, really, really funny video that I didn't show you guys about how to win at a lottery. And they actually did trot out various stats, basically saying that, oh, some percent of the time, two numbers, this is one of those lotteries where you pick six numbers and then, you know, and the number of numbers that correspond will get you a certain kind of payout. And it's like, some percentage of the time you will get two numbers very close that adjacent to each other, like the other 39 and 40 or something like that. And it's like, therefore you should pick two numbers. And it's like that makes no sense at all, you know, because the expected value is the same across all in that particular case, expected value is the same across all. But I think it's a good point to say, you know, that you get to choose how much variance you're willing to live with. Yeah. How much risk you're willing to live with, basically. Because in a game like Settlers, the nice thing about it is that going for the big payout increases the risk and increases the payout, basically. Or potential payout, basically. So, you know, that's a nice balance. That's a nice balance to have.
I don't know if anyone's played, it's not really a game, it's more of a math problem. Mm-hmm. It's a game there's three dice, they don't have 1 to 6 on them.
Mm-hmm.
They all each die have expected value 3.5.
Okay.
But by going against another one, then there's a higher probability of winning.
I don't play that one.
I know it's not learn to
take it up. That's pretty cool. Actually, can you put that up on the forum maybe?
Yeah, I can show you right now.
Oh sure.
I can work out this. It's the first cube has 3 5s on it and 3 2s.
Oh okay, multiple numbers. 3 5s and 3 3s?
3 2s.
3 2s.
So we have D6 in there, it's like made out. One of them is 5 4s and a 1.
5 4s.
So they all have expected values of 3.5, the same as a regular die.
Yeah.
The last one is 1 6 and 5 3s.
1 6 and 5 3s.
So they all have expected value of 3.5. Now the game is first player chooses a die and the second player chooses a die. And then you roll like the highest number in one roll.
Just the highest number in one roll.
Yeah.
And then do you re-roll with
just
the same dice?
No. So first player chooses the die, and the second player sees what the first person chose, and then the second player rolls. Chooses the die. So truthfully, the best pick if you're first is the best pick if you're second, even though they all have the same expected value.
I see.
So you want, if you're first, you want to flip the fours, is that right?
If you're
because,
first,
that, because the fives, twos beats fours, but by less than yeah. each other.
Yeah, I think probably yeah. if you choose the fours, they're more likely to win.
Yeah.
It's the first place.
I see. I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure if you're first, it doesn't matter if you choose 5-3 or 4, it's 6-3 is the worst.
Yeah. 6-3 is getting so dominated by the 4s that it's like not
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, but so, like, still would rather be second. Second always has.
Second always wins.
Or
second always has.
Always.
Yeah,
second probably
has a dominant
wins.
Guy.
So what you're describing is a strategy for the second player. Basically,
yeah.
is the, you know, if the first player picks things, you will pick something, and on average, you will win, though you will necessarily win.
It would be more interesting if we did it in two rounds.
Well,
in the first round, everyone takes a die sequentially, and then they roll to see who goes first in the pick. So then you're aiming to try and, like, hit the middle.
Wait, hold on. Repeat that one more time.
Well, so you randomly decide who goes first, right?
Okay.
So the first person chooses a die. And then the next person chooses a die, and the next person chooses a die. And they roll to determine the order of the actual game. So what you're trying to roll for is to get second place rather than first, because the optimal strategy is in the second choice.
Yeah. And you have 6-3.
Oh, that's bizarre.
Yeah, but the problem is if you take 6-3, you also have a pretty high chance of like getting your last player.
Oh, you use the same much twice, right?
Well,
yeah,
three, two, three. But yeah,
that kind of evolution is something which happens in real life as well,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It's like, okay,
yeah.
so there's clearly a dominant
yeah.
strategy, but then
yeah.
how you get to deciding what which strategy to use
yeah.
based on the information becomes a game.
That's
possible as well.
You know?
However, once it gets to that point, then you want to think about, well, maybe there's something you can do to your original game to sort of like make it easier for people to just get to that second level of the game. And you don't necessarily always have to, because there are going to be people who are just going to have fun at this point, just sort of like
yeah.
playing this game as opposed to sort of figuring out who goes first. But it'll be interesting if in the process of designing this game, you've got rules to actually let people decide who goes first. And the people who haven't figured out the dominant strategy, this is where the game is at, right? You know, just like the first person has an equally interesting choice as the second player, and then later on, when people start to realize that there are, you know, that there is actually a strategy, then they're playing the other game of who goes first. But it's, you know, it's, if you design your game right, then you can make it all the same game. It's just which set of rules are they most concerned about any given time. It'd be nice if your games could do that, but you know, let's see how complex they get.
Hey, before we completely move away from game theory, are you at some point going to mention the Prisoner's Dilemma? Because I think that's a great tool to try to look at dramatic tension and interesting decisions for players.
So that does have an optimal strategy.
Well, not
in a game where you're communicating with
There are two arguments about that one.
Well, no, I think, like, I guess if you actually have human beings,
the Prisoner's Dilemma, as covered in the reading, is I can't remember the exact numbers, but basically, you know, you've got two people.
Well, they didn't say exact numbers in the reading. Mm-hmm.
I'm probably thinking of different constables.
The one that I know is that.
Let's see, I know defect is one of the cases. Anybody remember what's the term used for cooperating?
Cooperating.
That's how they're really stupid, right? I wish I could understand.
Okay.
So, if both people cooperate, they get something like, what, 5 years in prison or something? So the idea is that, okay, so it's like the town, right? Okay, we have two people who are involved in the same bank heist, and they both get caught, but then there's not enough evidence to put both of them away for a real long time. So the basic idea is each of them are separated, and then cops tell them, if you give us information on the other guy, you know, then we will reduce your sentence, and that other guy is going to get hammered with the sentence, but we'll give you, get out of jail free card. So, but if you don't tell us anything, if you cooperate with your partner and don't give us the evidence that we need, we still have enough evidence to put you away for like 5 years. So that's where it is fine. Both of you will go away for 5 years. Now, of course, if you do decide to give us the information, then you maybe get away with just 1 year in prison. But the guy you just ratted on goes away for 7 years. And of course, if both of you decide to rat on each other, now we have like collusion charges. That's awesome. That's
it. Both of you go away for 10 years.
You need to make the defecting the less than a person cooperating and another defecting.
I've seen versions where it's not equal, but it
becomes a different game.
5, 1, 7, 3.
7, 1. You can
7. No, that's fine.
That's fine. The defect should be 6, 6.
Just,
yeah.
Defect should be. It should be 6.
Or it's worse than cooperating, but better than getting up.
Yeah. Well, you're right. 10, 10 involves too high. So this 5, 5 is probably too high too. But
don't matter as long as it has a relation.
All that matters is that no matter what your opponent does, get it even the same.
Yeah. Although,
but if you're looking,
this only that which is true for a single instance of this game. The thing that gets really complex is what happens if you had to play this multiple times because you're a multiple repeat offender bank robber who gets caught all the time.
You just give up.
And that's where you get into various mixed strategies. The strategy in the prisoner's dilemma is you should always betray your partner because on average you're going to come out ahead. Is that right?
The strategy is you do whatever the partner did to you last time.
No, that's
a single game, no repetition. You always turn out better than if you didn't defect.
So let me see. If you defect, then what happens is that you could get away with 1 or 6 years. Since you don't know what your opponent is going to do, that's something like 3.5, right? If you cooperate, then it's going to be between 3 and 7, so that's more like expected value of 5. That's your utility.
You're not trying to break this game, you're trying to get as low as possible.
The right way to think of it is actually say your opponent were to cooperate, then what if you were to cooperate? If you were to cooperate, you get 3 years, but if you were to defect, you get 1 year, so you should defect. What if they were to defect? Well, if you were to cooperate, then you'd get 1 year. If you were to cooperate, then you'd get 7 years. But if you were to defect, you'd only get 6 years. So you should defect then, too. So you should just always defect.
That's
the normal way
that
it is.
That's basically saying what's the minimum. It's weird because we're using higher numbers to represent bad things happening to you. But the whole principle of maximum is basically you're trying to maximize your minimum benefit, and the minimum benefit in this particular case happens in defect. Because the most that you can possibly get is 6 years in defect. If you ever cooperate, there is a chance that you're going to get 7 years. Maximum tells you what you defect. The only problem is, again, once you get into this repeated over many, many times, then you're in a situation where if you build up a reputation, then all you're going to do is defect, then you can pretty much assume that whoever you're playing against is also going to defect, at which point you will always just end up with 6 years. You will never be able to get here. There is a there is a concept that helped sort of like deal with situations like this that actually make cooperation again a viable strategy. I'm hoping I'm getting this right. Von Neumann in the reading suggests that there are saddle points. There are saddle points that basically means this is where all the strategies pretty much end up, because you know, because of the reasoning that we just described. You are maximizing the minimum payout, the minimum benefit that you're going to be making for the decision, and they all converge here. You know, everybody, if everyone did the same analysis, they all end up here. But John Nash comes along, and he suggests that there are other kinds of saddle points that could be found. And these are points where, assuming that everybody sticks with whatever strategy that they've got, if I were to change my strategy, I will end up in a poorer situation.
Defect
remains the one of the saddle points, which are all Nash equilibria. But the odd thing about it is that co-op actually becomes an unstable equilibrium. It's one of those things, especially in a multiple game. It's like if you're going to assume that you're going to be playing this game over and over and over and over again, switching out of co-op has a long-term detrimental effect, because especially if you know that other people have a strategy of basically, I'm going to do what you did to me. It's called tit for tat strategy. If you actually stick with co-op, and if everybody else is using the same reasoning as you are, which is another interesting little wrinkle that Nash throws in, is that whatever analysis you are capable of performing, everybody else is capable of also performing, because everybody's a rational player. Therefore, co-op actually becomes a unstable but possible equilibrium point. You know, because switching out actually leads to the net loss for yourself over the long term. That was kind of the little thing that he threw in that kind of made his name, and then you can watch a beautiful night. but the basic idea is, you know, it's that what is useful from a sort of one table like this becomes really, really interesting when you think about what you're going to do over the long term. I believe there's a couple of other strategies that involve things like, instead of just doing what I did to you last, you know, just sort of like, you know, well, if you defect, then I'm going to defect the next time, which actually turns out to be a pretty good strategy. But if you cooperate, then I'm going to cooperate next time. There's also strategies like, well, as soon as you defect, I'm going to do nothing but defect. And that actually works out interestingly. Because that actually changes the utility numbers in a way where, you know, where a single defection has a huge negative utility in a way that you might want to compute it differently. But for the most part, I think tit for tat turned out to be the best strategy over the long term, which was basically, depending on how the numbers are weighted, tit for tat basically says, whatever you do, I'm going to do to you next. And that actually turned out to be pretty good, because that actually mathematically showed that co-op actually works between two rational players. But yeah, when you're just looking at a single instance, if you're only going to get caught once, you always defect.
This also only works if there's an unknown number of future games. Because if you know you're going to play any finite number of times.
True.
Yeah. It seemed to be like...
Yeah, there is basically... Yeah, it's like induction, right? You're like, it goes on
forever. Exactly.
But, you know, you kind of hope that your game's going to get played an infinite number of times.
Yeah, planning for it.
Depending on it. So, you know, not an infinite number of turns.
Exactly. But,
yeah.
The winner can only resolve after an infinite number of rounds.
First one who gives up.
Right, exactly.
Opinion.
Mercy.
Okay, I really need to get some water. Everybody
break.
Yeah.
Game break.
I'm going to give a quick break, but does everyone have your us versus it sheets?
Yeah.
Okay, I will like to pick up on that in about 10 minutes.